Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Hank.
Where are we off to today?
Well, the thing that's primarily on my mind today is that it is my dad's 80th birthday.
Happy birthday.
I know. Happy birthday. We call him Jim.
Jim.
Mm-hmm. That's about as far as we could get with a grandpa name, because his name is Jim, but Jim is the grandpa name. And I guess when you hit 80, a lot of your primary identity is with all of the people that identify you as grandpa or Jim. So yeah, happy birthday to my dad. I'm actually leaving the minute we get off the air today and driving up to Monterey to have dinner with them, with my mom and dad and my brother. So I'm looking forward to that. But because it's my dad's birthday, a lot is on my mind around that, because 80 feels like a significant number. I mean, it is a significant number. And in, you know, the fastest growing age group in society are those 85 and older. So it's hard to see 80 as anything more than just a number along the path towards aging, because people are having such long and fruitful lives. A good deal of people are having long and fruitful lives. As a matter of fact, my dad was racing his sports car, his car, at Laguna Seca this last weekend. So I don't know if that is the traditional activities of an 80-year-old person, but that's my dad. And so, you know, although 80 is this big round number, it doesn't feel like kind of the let's wrap up life or put a bow on it. You know, it feels like it's still this opening of new possibilities, or how do we do a life review at this point and kind of let go of those things that we can no longer do and be okay with kind of letting that go, and then really embrace those things that we can do moving forward. I mean, even at my age, which I'll be 57 in a couple weeks, there's some things that I don't do anymore. So I think maybe that's just the whole process of aging, that we kind of let go of certain parts of our life and then we open up to new opportunities. But I had what I thought was an interesting epiphany, and you may roll your eyes and it means nothing to you at all, but you know, my parents had me when they were pretty young. My mom and dad, my mom was 19, my dad was 23. And so when I was thinking about my dad turning 80, you know, you have this vision of your parents as being kind of the wise elders, as they should be. They're the ones that guided you and nurtured you and taught you the, you know, what life is about. And so there is kind of this whole parents on a pedestal thing that we tend to have as children. But it dawned on me, thinking about my age and how close I am in age with my parents, that my parents were young. You know, they were still very unformed when I came along. And in a lot of ways, the three of us kind of grew up together, and my brother and sister thrown in the mix. That we really, I've had the opportunity to watch my father grow into the man he is today at 80. And that a lot of times we assume that our parents, you know, from the time we're born, have all this inherent wisdom and are now just these formed beings. But most of us, and I think about my own trajectory raising my girls, I was a little bit older when I had my oldest daughter, but I clearly was not fully formed. And I have grown and matured in the process of being her mother, and we've grown up together. I mean, for me, that felt kind of revolutionary to have that thought.
Well, in similar lines, you know, we're about the same age. I'm about to turn 55. And, you know, I think back kind of the same thing. You know, my parents imparted all this great wisdom on me. And I think back, they were like 30 when they did that.
Exactly.
And that, I was nowhere near as mature at age 30. I'm still not. But I can't believe, you know, I think of my parents as old people, because that's my most recent memory. But then when I think back when I was a kid, no, they were in their 30s and 40s when, right, and during my formative years.
Figuring these things out.
Yeah.
And if you and also I think about how much of my dad's life journey I've been a part of. Not that that makes us peers, but I don't know. It felt meaningful in this thought that I've had the privilege, because my dad's had the privilege of getting to grow old, to turn 80, is to develop into this person he is today. And there, I think that's one of the greatest privileges of being able to age, is that you get to grow into yourself? Because I don't know if we fully grow into ourselves. I mean, I feel like I have moments that I grow into certain parts of myself. I feel like when I hit 35, that felt pretty solid. And then, you know, if things changed again at 50, I felt there was this other shift. But I imagine with each generation, with each decade, there's some other magnificent unflowering of the potential of who we are. I mean, Carl Jung was one of the first developmental first psychologists to even recognize that we continue to advance developmentally past childhood into adulthood, because prior to his research, the common thought was that once you became an adult in your early 20s, that was all of the development that you went through. You had approach that adult mind, that adult brain, and then it was it. But Jung was the first person to recognize or start talking about how we do keep unflowering and unfolding and become different people with each decade. And, you know, Jung talked about that the whole process of individuation, which was his focus towards wholeness, really couldn't start taking place till after the age of 56, because we spent those earlier years, 20s, 30s, 40s, kind of being established in the world as we know it, that pragmatic world of, you know, finding a mate and raising children and a career and a home, getting established. And it wasn't until you had kind of established all of that that you could then look back at 56 and start to individuate, to understand yourself on a more spiritual or grander scale. You know, in the Chinese tradition is to not really celebrate birthdays in any way until you turn 60, for kind of that same idea that there isn't a lot of life experience that you've had before that, or you've had life experience, but really at 60, you've lived enough life that we should honor you with a big celebration. And then after that, every 10 years. And so it's amazing to me how we continue to flower and grow and unfold into 60, 70, 80, 90, when people didn't live to this age, right? Even a few generations ago. And so what an interesting process, another one of my strange little epiphanies, what an interesting process the whole development of the human being has been, because when people were dying at, you know, 40 years old of old age, were they having the same trajectory? Were they hitting 40 and having the wisdom that people at 80 are having now? Or because we're having a longer time period on Earth to develop and grow and have experiences, are we more fully enlightened or aware at 80 than people were when they were dying at 40? You ever think about that?
I try not to, but okay. Yeah.
That's this. You asked me what I think about, and there's where I am today. Because if, let's say the life expectancy gets to 100, just we should be big-headed humans by the time we're 100 years old, full of wisdom and enlightenment. And I think that goes along with what we see happening around the world, this kind of sense of enlightenment. And, you know, not to discount all of the terrifying, dark, horrible things that are happening all around us. What's happening at the same time, though, is that we're seeing unprecedented levels of enlightenment by people, spiritual awakenings, opening with their heart, feeling more connected, starting movements and revolutions that are human-centered, you know, understanding the interconnectedness of all of us. And so it seems that with each generation, with each decade, that we extend the life expectancy, the life cycle, people have more time to gain awareness and awakenness, and that the world itself then benefits from the changes, which again kind of collides and contradicts with this idea that one of our greatest struggles is overpopulation. So I'm conflicted about that, because as much as I think that the wisdom of the elders is essential for helping us move forward to find kind of a common sense of enlightenment, if there's too many of us, it sinks the ship as well. So I guess that's just life, right? It's just messy.
Well, and as longevity grows, what about the quality of life? I mean, if you're 95 and still having a blast, then that's great. But if you're, you know, wheelchair bound and you can't hear and your body's shutting down, then is it really worth getting to 100 if you're not enjoying those final few years?
Well, and that's another piece of it as well, because those who are like my dad racing, you know, a sports car at Laguna Seca at 80 are the outliers.
Sure.
He's not having the common experience And it's interesting, I don't know if you saw, but at the Palm Theater, there was a documentary that's been running for a while, Lives Well Lived, and it was actually directed and produced by a professor at Cal Poly, Sky Bergman, and it's a beautiful documentary, and it features a few local people who have grown to ripe old ages, Dr. Tadone and Bozzo Corcelli. And the thing that was interesting about the stories were that these people were, you know, making the most of their lives well into old age, was considered, you know, older age. But then, like you just said, you know, that quality of life piece, there was a little bit of me that felt like if I were someone who was having a more traditional trajectory of aging, you know, my health was failing, I wasn't able to do the things, I couldn't dance or still write or do the things that I love to do, would I watch this documentary and feel a little bitter? You know, like, who do you think you are having a great old age? Because the norm is kind of struggle. And should we have a coexisting documentary that shows what the vast majority of other people that are aging are experiencing? Life is messy, Hank. Yep. It's messy. And also thinking about my dad, as I think, I've been thinking about all the things that I've learned from him because he is my dad, those unique, you know, gifts that he's passed along. And I talked about last week, you know, my love of going out to the Babes Ride Out and motorcycles and fast cars and loud cars. And my dad still races cars, so I grew up around them. I love them. And it's, you know, a bit of a blessing and a curse to love fast, loud cars and to want to drive them all. But I love road trips because of my dad. That's why I do my, you know, shows from the road every summer, because I love driving across country and showing up in different places. So that's a great gift. And just my desire to engage strangers in conversation is definitely a gift from my father. He has never met someone that he couldn't find some connection with. But then on the other side too, a lot of my temperament is a gift from my father. We both struggle with, you know, anxiety and very highly sensitive to the world around us. And so I grew up, fortunately, with my dad having these same experiences. And when I struggled with them when I was younger, you know, he at least was able to normalize the experience that when I thought I was going to die of anxiety when I was young, he was always there to say, no, it will not kill you. You've got to kind of live through it and grow through it and, you know, become stronger in the face of it. And so that shared temperament that my dad and I have inspired my work as a psychotherapist, inspired me to get my master's to try to understand, you know, what is this way that I see the world and filter information and respond and kind of balance my mental health. And so sitting here in this chair today has a lot to do with those gifts and that modeling that I gained from my dad. And doing this work, one of the things that I really strive to do is to talk, you know, walk my talk, to be able to sit here every week and talk about things that I've experienced and dealing with and grappling with and paying attention to, so that I can talk about them in authentic ways. And one of the keys, the foundations of good mental health, are these four tenets: meaningful work, deeply connected relationships, service to others, and good health. And when you have all four of those things, you tend to have a really solid foundation for mental health and well-being. But what we don't talk a lot about when it comes to those four tenets to mental health, good mental health, is that you have to have all four of those things in some sort of balance. And if you don't, if you have too much focus on any of those things, too much focus on your meaningful work, too much focus on your deeply connected relationships, too much focus on your service to others, or maybe even too much focus on just your good health, if you're too focused on one of those areas, then that will cause deficits in the other areas, and then your mental health will slip. That you really can't have a full sense of well-being unless you have all four of those things in balance. And so one part of my brain is all around kind of my dad and wanting to celebrate his birthday and thinking about him. But the other part is thinking about my conversation with Nina Simons a couple weeks ago from Bioneers, and she was the guest speaker this weekend at the Central Coast Women's Symposium. And the center of her talk was about activism and women's leadership and how do we find our ways to being most effective as activists. And one of the things she said was in finding your way towards service to others was to defend what you love, to find that thing that you love. And so that had been on my mind. I'd been kind of stirring, like, how do I throw a show all around that? Because we talked about, you know, that burnout that can come for people who are really involved in activism, because there's so many causes. I mean, you and I could every week spend almost the whole hour just talking about all of the different causes that are near and dear to people's hearts. I mean, we talk about, you know, all the marches and protests and rallies that are happening. We could get overwhelmed by them. And what Nina talked about was, because she works with bioneers who are, you know, in the forefront of talking about all of the things that are going on in the world that need to be addressed. And she says, it's easy to get so overwhelmed that you burn out. And caregivers and people who do service or the helping professionals tend to have the highest rate of burnout in their lives because they're so motivated by love for what they're doing and love for others that they're imbalanced in the other parts of their life and end up kind of frying out. And so in order to have a sustained sense of activism, we have to have balance, and we also have to have kind of this centered idea of what it is we love and are working towards. So there's Nina, there's Dad. And then yesterday I'm sitting at my desk at work, and computers are magical to me. I don't understand a lot of things that happen sometimes, but I opened what I thought was an email from a student. And then it was this email memo that I think I sent to myself 3 years ago when I interviewed Jean Shinoda Bolen. I remember her. She's the archetypal psychologist, and she talks about the millionth circles, and she's a powerful woman in the activist world herself. And it was her lessons on finding our inner assignment. So she talks a lot about, as we age and grow and our lives change, that we move from one assignment to another in our lives. So, you know, I have completed my assignment of being a primary caregiver of my children. My girls are grown and opening to a new assignment. And that for a lot of women in midlife and men in midlife, right, that point where you're starting to transition out of your work or your kids are grown, there is this next assignment that we all look for. And it's that rumbling of that midlife crisis that a lot of people talk about. You never talk about it. Maybe you're too young at 55, but this antsiness that there's something else I should be doing, that I'm not quite comfortable in my skin. You know, the cliche is that men use that rumbling and run out and buy a Porsche, or they find a Stormy Daniels with that midlife crisis. But that yearning, that antsiness that we're feeling is, according to Jean Shinoda Bolen, this call coming to us that there is an assignment that we are now heading out to fulfill. And so this memo that popped up on my computer that felt like a message from above, because I don't know how it landed there, was her description of how we understand what our assignment is. And you find out, you can discover your assignment if your inner response to these three questions is yes. So are you ready for them?
Ready.
Okay. So if the thing that you think is your assignment is the correct assignment, you'll have the inner response of yes to one, is it meaningful? Personally, to you, is this quest meaningful for reasons that others may not know?
Okay.
Okay. Number two, will it be fun? Because growing into who we are or who we're meant to be and being with others who share values, the same values or interest in this thing that feels meaningful to us, even if it's filled with angst, is also fun because we're driven to it. It feels meaningful.
Sure. Absolutely.
I would have never thought of that one. So that kind of stunned me.
No, me neither.
Maybe I'm too German or something. But, you know, when I think of activism or my assignment, I feel like it has to be kind of this harsh marching along. But no, is it meaningful? Will it be fun? And then the third one is it motivated by love? Love for whoever or whatever it is you are trying to help or save or cause you're trying to further. It has to do with why we are here now. That motivation of love for whatever it is we feel we want to defend, which kind of blends into what Nina Simons was saying, is that the essence of our action has to be motivated by love, has to be fun, has to be meaningful. So your initial question of where are we today, or where are you going today, kind of revolves around this whole idea of, are we in our phase of a new assignment? Are you looking towards a new assignment, or are you deeply involved in something that you're actively inspired to do right now? And what is that? You know, I'm dying to know, what is it that you focus your attention down to and can really put your full attention to? And the other thing that I was thinking about is that we're all activists in some way. All of us are activists, although we may not identify it, because I never really think of myself as an active activist. I never identified that, because when I think of activists, I think of people who march, who actively protest, right? Who run for office, who organize campaigns or movements, or they do campaigns, they make calls, they connect others, they donate to things, they pitch in at events, they support public radio, you know, which I do. But I never saw myself as this like active person, like with t-shirts that have a cause on it. But Nina Simon said, we all have an activist in us. We just have to pay attention to what it is we're doing that is active. So I have an idea maybe of who I am in that definition. I'm grappling with the Jean Shinoda Bota idea of, you know, what is this thing that feels meaningful to me and is fun and is motivated by love? But I'm curious to know what you're thinking, what the listeners are thinking. What is it that is driving you? And then how does it relate to those tenets of good mental health? Because quite often we can get so devoted to that activism, to that service, that we lose sight of our meaningful work, that we don't tend to our deeply connected relationships, and that we don't pay attention to our health. So that's kind of where we're going today. I'm interested to see where everyone is with this idea of activism. And you can be part of the conversation by giving us a call at 805-781-3875. You can also find me on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. If you like the page, I put up the promos for shows each week and add pictures when appropriate. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can find previous shows at kcbx.org under the News Talk tab or Programs tab. We have years of shows to check in on. And if you'd like to stay current with the show, you can podcast by visiting Apple Podcasts, search A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, and shows will be uploaded, and you can listen at your convenience. So I look forward to having this conversation. I am Elizabeth Barrett. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back to take your calls.
You know that I'm still around. That's how strong I love you. Whoa. That's how strong I love you. That's how strong I love you, baby, baby. That's how strong I love you. I'll be the weeping willow, drowning in my tears. And you can go swimming when you were here. Be the rainbow after the tears are gone. Wrap you in my colors and keep you.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm thinking about my assignment, our assignments, and our mental health, because that is the focus of the show week after week, is how do we all keep our mental health balanced, our well-being balanced? Are we living in such a way that supports our collective well-being? And sometimes even with our best intentions, we can throw our own lives out of whack. So let's go back to the keys to that good mental health. Meaningful work, which is interesting because we all have to define what meaningful work is to us. You know, the obvious meaningful work, people would say, oh, if you're a doctor or a helping professional or a teacher, you know, there seems to be some obvious path towards meaningful work, but that's not necessarily the full definition. Because if you are doing work that supports your family, that allows you to be able to buy a home or to live in an area that you like, or to have time, good time with your family, then that work is meaningful. If that work provides for you a life that the quality of life that you hope for. And, you know, it's something that I bring up with my students a lot in class, because it feels like that push that we have through college is down this conveyor belt towards, you know, education, education, education. You spit out and then you find your work and develop your career. And then you somehow try to fit family and relationships into that career you've created. And it always feels flipped to me that we should focus more on that career and work we do than on the relationships that ultimately support us, right? Because at the end of our life, and it's a cliche, but at the end of life, no one says, I wish I'd spent more time at work. People say, I wish I'd spent more time with our family. So I always have concerns with that. What is the thing that we're teaching young people about what they should be focusing all their attention, energy on? So that first key to good mental health is meaningful work, however it is you define it. And I think, I mean, you talk about how much you enjoy this work all the time, and that it's something that you knew you were going to enjoy doing, and you've never looked back.
30 years.
Yeah.
In one job. That's pretty amazing. I look back, and I never have long-reaching goals. When I got this job, I was like, okay, I'll keep this job till it's time to move on. And that's the way I've been with every job. But this one has kind of clicked. But, yeah, I mean, I have goals beyond KCBX, not career-wise, but I'd like to travel more. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd like to spend more than a long weekend in Vegas or San Francisco. and I actually do have a very nice trip planned in the next 6 months. We're actually going to Europe. So
that's...
but.
Awesome.
Yeah.
But then that goes back to my tenet of good mental health, is that your work is meaningful because it's providing you with the opportunity to pursue goals and dreams that you have.
Yes.
And aside from being able to pursue the goals and dreams that you have, what is it inherently that feels meaningful to you, like in your day to day? What is it you think, you know, this makes me feel like a job well done? I leave feeling like it's a job well done.
If we're still on the air when I leave the the building at night, then I feel like it's a job well done.
Do you have dreams that the air station's going off the air and you can't get there and make it start to be on the air again?
Not exactly that dream. I have the classic DJ's dream where, and it's actually evolved as technology has evolved. It used to be that I'm playing a record and the record runs out, mm-hmm. and I run down this long hallway to grab another record only to find it's a 20-second record. And now it's CDs, of course. But that's the only real nightmarish thing, and I share that among a lot of radio employees.
Oh, but, I've had them. I still have them, and I don't play music.
Yeah, and getting into a new, you know, rushing in at the last minute and finding that there's all new equipment around you that you have no idea how to work, and, you know, you're on the air in 5 seconds, that kind of thing. Those are my anxiety dreams. But aside from my working career, I've always enjoyed travel. I haven't gotten to do too much of it lately, but I've got a experience coming up in 6 months, and hopefully we'll be able to travel even more as I get older and accumulate vacation
and time
and save up and money and time. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's all those pieces that, and it goes kind of into the aging well piece, that at, you know, 50, I would imagine at 50, when 40 years ago, people were not saying, well, and when I'm 70, I'll go traveling. I mean, we tend to have the luxury of more time to think about the future. So that first tenet of good mental health, that meaningful work, really is defined by each person of how that work supports their life. The second one is deeply connected relationships. And that one is a struggle because relationships are messy, just like life is messy. And it takes a lot of commitment and perseverance to stick with relationships. Personalities, you know, are tough. And I've noticed, even with my husband and I, we've been together since I was 19, which is interesting because that's when my mom and dad got married. But I've been with my husband my whole life. And then we've both changed and grown. And I feel that we go through these periods of change where we're redefining who we are as a couple or together. And so that work towards maintaining those deeply connected relationships. And it's also another you know, thing that my father passed down was this, you know, commitment to that person you start the journey with and staying the course. So maintaining those deeply connected relationships takes time. You know, research shows that for couples who consider themselves to not necessarily be soulmates, but to be each other's primary support, right? Couples that are really invested in each other. In order to maintain that deep connection, it takes 20 hours a week of intimate time, conversations, going for walks, you know, things outside of just tending to the kids or feeding the animals or, you know, paying the bills. Because we generally, as couples who are working both full time, spend less than 30 minutes a week really having deep conversations. And so when you talk about spending 20 hours together, that's, you know, all weekend or each evening for a period of time, that's a huge gap in investment in the relationships. And then you throw in there, you know, the old school mental health thought that if you spend too much time with someone, you're too deeply engaged in that relationship, that you're enmeshed. And so as therapists, we spend a long time trying to, you know, tell couples you need to have these individuated lives and kind of live as roommates, which was contradictory to the research when they talked to people that had been married 40, 50 years and said, you know, what do you attribute to your success as a couple? They often said, oh, well, I live with my best friend. This is the person I would rather be with than anyone else, not because I need to have them, but because I genuinely love hanging out with them. And so that contradicted to what, you know, therapists were telling clients, which was you need a full life outside of your marriage. So that that definition of deeply connected relationships gets more and more challenging as technology intervenes, as, you know, people are encouraged to delay having deeply committed relationships so they can pursue their own activities. And
are you anywhere near the 20 hours?
With Chris?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we are. You know, we have times that we're better at it than others. But I'll tell you, in all honesty, we do much better as a couple when we have the 20 hours than when we don't. That I definitely feel this friction or kind of, I don't know, this gap in us when that time isn't there. How about you?
Not 20 hours. I mean, maybe a half hour every day, and then on weekends, especially when we walk the dogs. That's usually when we're the best conversations.
But are you together during the day all weekend? Like, do you do chores?
Yeah.
Well, that counts.
Okay.
You're not taking off and running a marathon.
Nope.
Yeah. So that I think a lot of people make up that 20 hours on their weekend times together. Yeah. And then the third one, so the deeply connected relationships, and again, that tends to be the one when we talk about mental health that is the most challenging for people to maintain. And the next one is service to others. And it's interesting that service to others is noted as a key to good mental health. It works extremely, extremely well with adolescents who are struggling and people in their 20s, because we've spent so much time having them be focused on themselves that it's important that they learn to step outside of themselves and work for something, the common good, something, you know, that makes them feel like they're a part of something greater than themselves. That's why, you know, I'm such a fan of the National Service Year, you know, doing AmeriCorps or working for a year someplace for a nonprofit, because that service to others fills a part of our psyche that's essential. But then there is that chance that we take that when we're so committed to an activism, an issue, a cause that we care deeply about, then that can overwhelm our time that we spend in our relationships, or it can prevent us from taking care of our health or impact our meaningful work. So as I talked about earlier, kind of the focus of today is our service to others, is our sense that we are driven by all of these causes that need our attention, causing us to not nurture love in our life or to come from a place of love and make sure we're fulfilling or filling ourselves with love to sustain us. And then the last one is good health. And good health is an interesting part of the mental health, the four tenets of mental health, because as you mentioned, you know, part of good health is kind of a crapshoot. You know, we can eat well and get our exercise and do the best we can, but then there is the genetics and some things that we can't control. So we do the best we can with good health.
And there's also there's this, at least with me, constant weighing of, because I hate to exercise, and how much misery should you put yourself through when you could be enjoying your life? Are you cutting your life short by not exercising, or are you living longer in misery by going jogging every morning at 6 a.m.?
Well, then it is the end. You know, you can be the most fit runner in the world and something genetic causes your life to be cut short.
Sure.
So they're all, it is, it's messy. It's all that dance. So I guess I'm throwing it out there again. You know, what is it that motivates you in your day to day? Is there something that you're passionate about, that you're an activist about, that you march and write for or protest for? Are you running for office? There's over 500 women running for office right now, which is incredible. Are you someone who organizes movements or events? Are you part of the Slow Women's March, who's having a big rally on March 24th against gun violence? Are you someone who makes calls? Do you connect people together? Are you someone who donates? Do you pitch in at cleanup days or different activities? What is your activism that as you see it, and does it feel balanced with the other parts of your life? 805-781-3875 is a number to be part of the conversation today. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. I'm joined by Hank Hadley today. He's hanging out. We're grappling with this idea of our causes and our activism and feeling like we want to have a good balance in our life of all of those pieces of our mental health. We both agree that our meaningful work mental health piece is pretty handled. I definitely love the work that I do. We both work pretty hard on our deeply connected relationships, paying attention to that. I have found myself over the years having to trim back some commitments so I had to make room for my granddaughter. Like when you bring new people into your life that you want to build those relationships, you kind of have to make choices and decisions of cutting back on certain things. Service to others. As I mentioned, I don't see myself as an activist in the way that I view activists. You know, when I meet Nina Simons or Jean Shonda Bolin or different people are out speaking and holding offices, I admire them. But then I think about the fact that I'm sitting here every Tuesday and researching and sharing information that feels like activism from a deep place. And then that good health piece. And you talked about kind of the older we get, the more challenging it gets to stay committed to all those good health pieces. And then, you know, you look at, because I'm standing in front of a classroom of 20-somethings all the time that are abusing their bodies on a regular basis, and it takes all of my gusto to not want to be my grandmother and say, you know, why are you wasting your bodies? Take good care of yourself. Get good sleep because you're going to care about it when you're, you know, 80 years old. And then nothing worse than probably an 80-year-old going in and chastising young people. I wish I'd taken care of myself. It's just all the messiness of life. Who was it that said that youth is wasted on the young?
It's a good quote. I don't know who said it.
So I know that it caught you a little off guard when I talked about the assignment piece, but do you ever feel that rumbling midlife thing? Do you have that, like, what else is out there voice?
Well, I mean, I've got the feeling that time is going way too fast. Mm-hmm. And, should I go out and you know, experience a little more than just the day-to-day that seems like you, I mean, when you're in your 20s, it just seems like it'll go on forever.
I know, you have lots of days to waste.
Yeah, and now that you're in your mid-50s, you can see that there's actually is a light at the end of the tunnel.
Mm-hmm. that you'll be moving towards before you know it.
Yeah, but as far as a specific assignment, I don't, like I said, don't have enough foresight to see a specific goal that I'm.
You're not listening.
Towards. Yeah.
Well, and so when I was talking this over with Nina Simons, and I brought it up again to my husband and anyone and you now, anyone who will listen to me about this idea of, you know, what is that thing that's calling to us, and how do we recognize that thing that we love and want to defend? Because for a lot of people, again, there's a lot of causes that catch our attention, and we feel this kind of pull and this guilt towards, I need to do something about that. But we're not sure what to do, and then it just feels overwhelming, so we do nothing. And so instead of trying to find a place to jump in and do our part, to kind of look more inward and see, what is it you're already doing and may not recognize it as activism? What is the thing that you love that motivates you by love? You know, someone that you love and care for and want to protect or save or help or take care of, or something that you love and want to protect and take care of. What is it that you love and want to defend and care about? And I was thinking about just because of my position as a therapist, the thing that I probably most stand in the corner of is relationships. That I am a defender of the importance of relationship. And it was interesting because one of the things Nina talked about in how to women lead differently, the model of feminine leadership as opposed to kind of that masculine leadership, was that feminine leadership focuses on the relationship before the task at hand, that building consensus, that respecting each other's voices, that paying attention to each other, nurturing those connections was primary. And when everyone feels connected to each other and loved and supported by each other, then you have the energy to take action as a group in meaningful ways. And that's a total shift from this idea we're going to come to, we're going to fight and grapple. And, you know, because the thing that takes down nonprofits and organizations and movements all the time is all of the scrambling by those who joined out of concern for the cause, but they can't come together as a group, and it destroys the whole hierarchy or the whole organization. And so one of the shifts to this feminine leadership is, first, let's nurture all the people who are coming together out of love for this cause, nurture those relationships. And then when that relationship is strong, you are able to move forward. And so there's probably, if it's for me, the actual idea is the standing on the side of relationship and the importance of nurturing them and spending time with others and not be embarrassed to say that, you know, as my introduction says, I'm a wife and mother and grandmother first and foremost. Those are the things that I defend and stand for first, and then everything else kind of falls in balance behind it. When you introduce yourself, what is that thing that you most identify yourself as? And you and I could talk about this all day, but I'd sure like to know if anyone else is feeling that pull towards activism, or maybe I'm the only one who cares, because I feel like this comes up a lot for me, and maybe I'm the only one who grapples with this idea of assignment, but I'd love to know, you know, what is the thing you do? How do you honor the activist in you, the steps that you take? What is the thing that you love? 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of the conversation, and we'll be back in a moment to take your calls. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
The sky was dark this morning when I raised my head. I stood at the window, the darkness was my bane. But suddenly a sunbeam thrilled me to my weary heart. It was the prettiest thing I'd ever seen. I knew I had to keep my love alive. Keep my love. Keep my love alive. Oh, baby, I want you to roll me, hold me in your love. No more habits, promises, and jive. Ever since I was a baby girl, wanted one thing most in this world.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and we are working to keep our love alive today. What are your thoughts? Anything bubbling up for you? 805-781-3875.
Now, do you actually contribute? I mean, I know you've been on women's marches and things. You say you're not a gung-ho activist, but you do contribute.
Yeah, I do. I don't think that I'm the marching with the bullhorn person, although I'd always be happy to get up and be a speaker, you know, for a panel or an activity. I think, you know, my activist gift is that I definitely can talk about the things I'm passionate about, but I always admire the people that I see having that cause so deeply rooted in them that they are out there with their sign speaking on behalf of the thing that they care most about, that they're organizing and starting movements and campaigns. And I admire that. I admire that energy. But I also, again, worry about those that are putting so much energy and love out there on the front lines, burning out and not paying attention to their own health and their relationships at home and the work that they're doing. So to try to keep it all in balance in some way. And I think maybe my walk the talk is that I tend to try to keep things super balanced all the time. To have everything kind of happen as it should. I don't know. 805-781-3875. Hi, Alice, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm wanting some further distinction between those two aspects of the inner assignment. Is it meaningful, mm-hmm. and is it motivated by love?
Okay.
In my mind, those seem at least very close or related. And just a comment, I do feel very burned out. I'm doing things that I think really need doing. Mm-hmm. They're very meaningful, but they're sure not fun. They're hard work.
Do you mind sharing what it is that is your cause?
Well, several. One is working with homeless outreach services in Los Osos, where we don't have really services except what a pretty small group of people. We're getting warming shelters and community dinners, and we're working on safe parking, those kinds of things.
Wonderful.
Also, I'm collecting signatures for a petition to put on the November ballot, a proposition that would ban fracking and more oil wells in our county. That's very important to me, very important, and it's very hard getting more and more signatures. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, you're interacting with the public, and it's tough.
Your boots on the ground.
Yeah.
And remember, so the meaningful part you get because you personally feel invested in both of these issues and motivated by love for the people and love for the land. So I get those. The third one was, will it be fun? As you said, that's when you grapple with.
Yeah.
And I understand that too, because I think I mentioned that I always look at, you know, doing volunteer work or helping other people. It's just, I'm giving and giving and giving. So I guess the question is, who is it and what is it you look forward to when you're doing this activist work? Because that's what Jean Bolin would say. To make it fun, there needs to be an aspect of it, even if it's as simple as they make really good coffee at the meetings, you know, or we bring a good snack, or I really always enjoy talking to this person who I only see because of this event. That she said to find the fun, we have to create the fun by looking for aspects of this service that is enjoyable for us. So would there be those pieces for you?
Right now, I have met a new friend through the petition thing, and so that's lovely when I get to see her. So that's a positive. Mm-hmm. With respect to the homeless issues and things, that just feels needed, but I don't know how to find fun in that.
Right.
It's just, you know, that's really tough.
It's heart-wrenching.
Yes, it is.
And I wonder if the fun in that is maybe sharing something of yourself that you love with some of the people that you're serving.
Yeah.
Like, is there something that in your life, a hobby or activity or passion that you have that you could incorporate into your service with the homeless to share with, you know what I'm saying, to bring that into it so that you're not just giving of yourself as kind of this faceless person, but you bring some of your own passion and share that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think also a good bath with some bubbles and a glass of wine never hurt.
Yeah. You're right about that.
Alice, thank you for taking the time to call.
Thank you. Thank you for the program.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Nancy, what do you think?
Well, I was so totally thrilled to hear what you said about the three things, mm-hmm. because I'm 73, and that's exactly what I do, are those three things. And what do I do? Well, I teach Qigong. I teach it for free. I teach it at the senior center. I teach it at my house for women. And, well, I swim 3 days a week. I advise people on their health. I have a PhD in nutrition. I'm a registered dietitian.
Wow.
I've gone through my years. I help run Measure Q, trying to get GMOs out. But my attitude is to do the very best for myself, for my health, which I do, and to share with others however I can.
And, is the fun for you teaching, or is it the people that you meet? What brings the fun for you in this assignment?
I would say doing it and having people enjoy it and really appreciate it,
mm-hmm.
and meeting the people and meeting new people. And it's, for me, it's a way of interacting. I'm not the type to go and, you know, have tea,
mm-hmm.
but it's a way of meeting people too.
I love that. So finding a way to bring your passions into creating a social life, because isolation is something that's really prevalent for people as they age, if they leave your, you know, day-to-day work life behind. So we have to work really hard to stay connected, and it seems you found that in a meaningful way.
Yes, thank you. Yes, I
absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, Nancy. Thank you for doing the work that you do.
Thank you very much.
And Bill, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, Elizabeth. How are you?
I'm doing great.
A couple of thoughts. First is this idea that, you know, the things we do to better society need to be fun. And I'm coming into the conversation a little bit late, so I didn't really catch everything you said early on.
Okay.
But just if you permit me a second here, I'll try to put this into some kind of context. I raced cars professionally for 15 years. And having done that, everybody thinks, so that must have been a lot of fun. And
mm-hmm.
the truth is, it really wasn't a lot of fun. It was a lot of hard work. And what made it compelling rather than fun, I think, is the people I met, the competition I appreciated, the man-machine interface, trying to get as much out of the car as possible, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't fun. It was, again, compelling, but not really fun. Now, against that backdrop, I'll tell you, I have started a nonprofit transition home for formerly incarcerated men.
Mm.
And you know, similarly, it's not particularly fun.
Right.
It's a real challenge. And I love the men that we bring in, and you know, I love that we're doing something good. I love that we're helping them land softly after usually decades in prison. But I'd really struggle to call it fun. So,
but it's clearly meaningful, and it's motivated for love, out of love. And so I think that fun part, and I maybe didn't catch it early on in the conversation, in that I said that that's the one I struggle with too, because I always associate work as being something that should feel like work, and fun isn't necessarily part of it. But then that causes us maybe to burn out on that thing that we were once motivated by love to do. And so I guess your assignment would be, how do you draw some fun from what you're doing? I don't have an answer for it right now. I'm just kind of grappling with it too. Because I think, you know, some things naturally lend itself to it. But Jean Shinoda Bolen, who I took this this assignment questionnaires from in working with her, she says that, you know, the fun part is being with people who you were meant to share this time with, being with others who share your values that you care about. Even in the angst of doing it, there's fun, because even in the most dismal of situations, we can find humor if we have people on the journey with us.
Yeah, and I agree with that overall. I still struggle with the term fun. You know,
I hear you.
And I guess I would move more toward deep satisfaction or deep meaning.
I agree.
But
I think you and I both need then to grapple with the fun part because I do agree, but when I step back and think about it, I really do feel like the thing that causes the burnout is that there that lack of joy or lightness in it that has to be. Because I remember when I worked for the county for 15 years, that even though this sounds horrible, but some of the best parts of working in the county was when the therapists got together and we talked about our cases and we could share kind of the dark humor in some of the really heavy things we dealt with, but only those of us who were doing the work could kind of get it. And there was some fun in that. I looked forward to it, and the snacks were good. And you know that and I think ultimately that maybe that's the only thing that we have, but we really need to find that or we burn out. And just as another side, I don't know if you listened to the beginning, but my dad races cars. I grew up with him racing.
I heard that.
Okay.
Yes.
So please send me an email because I'd love to hear about the transitional home that you've created because it's something I don't know about. So if you don't mind, send me an email. Maybe we can talk about this further and I can connect you to my dad as well.
I'm sorry to say part of that dropped out.
No, that's okay. I said, if you send me an email, I'd love to hear more about the work you're doing with the transition for men who were incarcerated, because I think it might be something we could talk about further.
I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you so much, Bill. And thank you for taking the time to call.
Thank you for your time. Take care.
So it sounds like if there's a theme that the people are lacking the fun. And,
yes.
But I think you can make fun. I mean, here at work, it's not all fun.
No.
I mean, people's computers crash. You know, I get a message, yesterday's Fresh Air is playing right now, fix it. And that's not fun. But I get to work every morning and I get to hang out with great people. And that's fun, you know, saying good morning to Frank every morning. And that's fun. You know?
You start to find those little jokes. And those little kind of, you and I have our little banter that we do.
Yeah,
and text.
That's fun.
And I think that is part of. And I heard Bill saying too, I always thought it was my Germanic background that I struggle with fun when it comes to work and things. So maybe that is part of the assignment. I'll post these three questions about how do we find our assignment up on my Facebook page. You can like our page and hear more about the show. You can listen to previous shows by podcasting through Apple Podcasts. You can visit kcbx.org and listen to previous shows. You can always send me an email to Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. As always, I appreciate your supporting Public Radio KCBX, and I look forward to speaking to you again next Tuesday at 2.
It was another lifetime, one of toil and blood. The blackness was a virtue, and the road was full of mud. I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. And if I pass this way again, you can rest assured I'll always do my best for her, on that I give my word. In a world of steel like death and men who are fighting to be warm, come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. Not a word was spoke between us, there was little risk involved, and everything up to that point had been left unresolved. Try imagining a place that's always safe and warm. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. I was burned out from exhaustion, buried in the hail, poisoned in the bushes and blown out on the trail. Haunted like a crocodile, ravaged in the corn. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. Suddenly I turned around, she was standing there, silver bracelets on flowers in her hair. And she walked to me so gracefully and took my crown of thorns. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from a storm. Well, the deputy walks on hard nails and the preacher rides a mount. Nothing really matters much, it's doom alone that counts. And the one-eyed undertaker, he blows a funeral horn. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. Question, man, is it hopeless and forlorn? Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from a storm. Well, I'm living in a foreign country, but I'm bound across the line. Beauty walks a razor's edge, someday I'll make it mine. If I could only turn back the clock to when God and her were born. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from a storm.